All right, today is August 6th, 2015. This is the follow-up interview with Chris Peniston. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. My name is Troy Reeds with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Chris, to make sure I have the recorder where I need it, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, Chris Peniston, P-E-N-N-I-S-T-O-N.
Okay. The only way this one works well is to... I may have to just get a little closer to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's better? Yeah,
yep, that'll be better.
Okay.
all right. So, as you noted from the email I sent, I have a few sort of follow-up questions, see if we can get a bit more information about some stuff. You mentioned ILS, or Integrated Liberal Studies. Uh-huh. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and maybe start by how you knew about it and then became involved in the program.
So it was during the SOAR session the summer before the fall of 1980. SOAR is the annual orientation program that students, freshmen, incoming students go through. And I realize now sometimes people's parents come with them, but none of the parents, I don't think, were there at that time of other students like myself. So I went to this SOAR session, and there were presentations by different people, as I recall, but there was a special sort of presentation by this group of faculty who comprised the Integrated Liberal Studies program. And I remember sort of didn't know anybody at the SOAR program, but sort of buddied up with one person who is now, you know, one of my best friends. We stayed in touch all these years, but and we both said, boy, that sounds kind of interesting. And I think both of us had been involved in sort of the artistic things in high school, theater, band, you know, orchestra, the theatrical side of things. And I guess maybe for that reason, you know, we were sort of drawn to it. Not that there was an artsy component to the ILS program, but they did sort of, what was attractive to me was that it promoted sort of a world view. You know, I didn't even realize, you know the word humanities at that time, but I'm pretty sure what they were articulating was sort of a just humanities approach to college. And they also promoted the fact that you would, you know, probably form some kinship with some other students who were taking the same core classes that you were. So it was, I guess, attractive because I wasn't really decided as a major. So I didn't come in knowing I'm going to do engineering or teaching or whatever. And B, because, you know, this sort of idea of learning multicultural sort of things, world things, was appealing to me.
Okay.
And it turns out that a lot of the other students that were in the ILS program were those who were like-minded with respect to me in being liberal. They were the ones I saw at the protests. They were the ones, you know, a lot of them were involved in student activism. It turns out that just, I don't know, by sheer luck or by design, who knows, you know, a lot of us were very progressive and progressive-minded and sort of activist-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Something I try to ask everybody, and it has nothing to do with your activism on campus, but it's interesting to me, and that's sort of, you know, after SOAR, eventually you have to register for classes.
Yep.
And from what I've heard, you know, registration was a much different process.
Yeah.
Sort of pre-automated registration process. So
it
I wonder
was...
if, sort of just in general, if you could talk about your memories and your thoughts about having to register, you
it
know,
was
pre-computer.
Amazing. Yeah, it was amazing. I came from a small school, had never seen the kind of numbers of people that I saw. The summer had been quiet. Like I said, I moved here right after high school and started working here. But then registration week, which was sometime in late August, we all had to trek down to the Stock Pavilion. And there were stations set up there, and you had to go through the stations and, I don't know, get your ID, probably was one of them, you know, be issued your number, which at that time was our Social Security numbers. And then you went through these stations where you would register for classes. And then there was some steps after that. You had to actually go to some of the classrooms that you were interested in taking it, and the professor would be there or some other person would be there, and they would look at this list and sort of count the numbers, you know, yeah, you're in, or, oh, you should have gotten here a half hour earlier, or whatever. And then you had to make all the rounds to all these different places. And then I think we ended up, I forget where we ended up, but we ended up in this place, was it the Red Gym? I don't remember now, where there was all kinds of student groups. And I don't remember if this part was required, but it seems like we all went through it. And you had to sort of pass through this gauntlet of student groups that were all sort of saying, you know, join us, join us. It's a little bit like if you saw that movie, Pitch Perfect, I think it was called, where she goes to college and then they're all out, all these tables are outside where the people are saying, join me, join me. It was like that, only it was indoors. But yeah, registration was a very laborious, you know, you had to walk really far and take all these pieces of paper with you wherever you went, and people would give you passes or, you know, give you sign-in registration sheets or whatever. It was interesting.
Did it ever get easier as you went along?
Well, it took me 7 years to graduate, so I was an undergrad for 7 years. I don't remember if any of those years were automated. I don't think so. It does seem like there was something other than going to the Stock Pavilion, making that annual trek down to the Stock Pavilion, which was covered in sawdust. I mean, it was just like they had just let the animals out. I don't remember. It probably got easier. In fact, I think we did some things by phone, which seemed... I think there was some phone aspects of things which seemed a little easier, but yeah. Well, I was there anyway. There was never computers.
Yeah, I know. By the late 80s, early 90s, there was some phone aspects. You could call in, and I didn't go to school here. I'm just saying, in general, that you could call in and punch buttons.
I'm thinking that's what happened. Yeah, for at least some of the parts of it. Yeah, yeah. And that you asked earlier about, you know, just how did you get involved? I think, and I said this earlier too, you know, there was more of a face-to-face. You confronted people and ideas in a physical way rather than just looking on the computer, Googling something, or looking on Facebook. And I don't know that it was better that way than it is now, but it was different. And it was harder to, you know, if you wanted to be polite and nice, you couldn't exactly say to this person, get out of my face with that thing, whereas on a computer you just click the button that takes you away, you know, the back page or whatever. And here you, if someone really wanted you to know something, they would kind of hound you and follow you, and you really had to kind of be rude, and most of us weren't very rude at that point, so we listened.
So this event, sort of end event, or whatever, might have been in the Red Gym with student groups. That's different than the stuff you were seeing in Memorial Union.
Right, so there was that sort of beginning of registration week, and it was called registration week, and that gives you a sense right there of how, you know, probably this was a days-long process that you had to do all this running around. I don't recall, but I guess I can't think how you'd do it all in one day, considering everything that had to be done. So, yeah, there was this whole feeling of beginning of the semester, all the fraternities and sororities were trying to recruit members and telling you where their parties were, and all the student groups that were trying to get new members for the year were there. And then, in addition, then every day thereafter, practically throughout the entire semester, there were tables at the Memorial Union. And you had to sign up for those. You could sign up maybe maximum of twice a week or something. But yeah, that some of the same groups that had tables at registration week were there. But more so, I guess, in the Memorial Union, there was more of the political groups. Whereas at registration week, there was those, but also all the other, you know, service-oriented groups, volunteer groups, frats, sororities, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Was it upstairs, meaning like the Great Hall or Trip Commons? Do you remember where the tables were?
When you would walk into the
Union? When you'd walk into the Union.
Right in the beginning, right in the entrance of the Union.
Okay.
So it was, the layout was different. There was not where the store is now, where you buy, like, soda and stuff like that. That was the sweet shop, so that was the deli.
Okay.
So there was nothing in the area where the deli is now. And so I think there were bathrooms there, but there was more space. And so that's where tables would set up, would be in that space. You'd have tables right next to each other. And you'd have the Republicans, the College Republicans, maybe next to the Spartacus Youth League or, you know, some Marxist-Leninist group or something.
So let's, I guess, carry on sort of somewhat chronologically, or maybe not even chronologically, but just on the follow-up questions. I have next about the Guerrilla Theater, but the bus trip to New York City might be, might have happened before that. So I just maybe just, you know, if you've thought more about that bus trip, I just did a quick Google and there was, it said there was a big rally in 1982 in New York City.
That was a million people. So, yeah, I mean, 1980 and 81, Reagan had just gotten elected. There were the issues related to the budget cuts and financial aid cuts, which was really big. And we got working with student government at that point, who had just taken over from, I don't know if you remember this, the Pail and Shovel Party, which were a bunch of goofballs. And they did crazy things. And, you know, Statue of Liberty in Lake Mendota. And so they left, I think, in 79 or 80. And the people that took over in 1980, right when I was coming to college, were very progressive, but they had this sense of having to rebuild. And, you know, there was a lot of waste in those years. You know, it cost money to do some of those things, some of those shenanigans. And these folks were more interested in doing things that really meant things. So they were our allies when it came to budget cuts and financial aid cuts. And we worked with them to, you know, use whatever legal routes there were as students within the university, you know, going to the Board of Regents, that kind of thing. So there was a groundswell of activity in 1980 because the TAA strike had just ended, because the draft and registration was just, maybe Carter reinstituted that or something, I don't remember, but there was that. And there was people on campus who were actually refusing to register and were becoming kind of famous for that. And then the budget cuts. And then in those early years, 1881, too, there was El Salvador and Nicaragua and U.S. involvement there. And, you know, we, as progressive students, were supporting the revolutionaries in those countries. And underpinning all of that was still the Cold War and this idea that there was still the chance that we could use a bomb, or that, you know, if things got bad enough in Central America, you know, that there could be a bomb. You know, it did seem as if this was a possibility. And so, you know, a lot of anti-nuke stuff on campus, student organizations, there were rallies. We, at the Progressive Student Network, we, that was one of the issues we did work around and focus around. So when 1982 came and there was national coalitions that were forming to call for this rally, we took busloads out there. And probably the biggest rally, as I recall, that had ever been assembled for that purpose or for that reason. And yeah, it was very exciting. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into organizing a bus trip, and a lot of organizing and politicking, you know, that was part and parcel of how we got the movement going. So I don't remember how many buses, multiple buses we took out there, and then slept in churches and buildings, you know, where we just slept on the floor, basically, for the overnight period of time. But that was a very exciting moment. And like I said, the Cold War was still maybe raging, you would even say. And there were these hot spots around the world of conflict and the real thought that, yeah, something could actually happen. So that was a really, there was a lot of single issues. You know, the Central American Solidarity Movement was beginning at that time. So CISPIS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, which became an international organization, was just beginning at that time. So a lot of single issues, the anti-nuclear stuff being one of them. But then those of us that went, you know, also raised other issues. You know, yeah, we're against nuclear power, and we're against U.S. and El Salvador, and we're against Reagan's budget cuts. So, you know, there were single issues and single issue events, but at all these events, there was a lot of us trying to infuse, you know, multiple issues of concern.
Do you have specific memories or I guess, memories that jump out from that? I mean, it had to be sort of a whirlwind, multi-day, you know, bus ride to New York, be in New York and back to New York.
Yeah. Well, we did a lot of those. We went to Washington several times, organized bus trips for a lot of different events, and it was always you spend a day in the bus, you know, if not 24 hours, a good part of 24 hours, and then you get out and you're there hopefully in time for the big rally, and maybe you spend the night and leave the next day, but more often than not, for a lot of these events, and mostly it was either Washington we were going to, Washington, D.C., or shorter trips, like maybe Chicago, but then it was usually get back in the bus after the event was over, you know, and leave right from there. Sometimes there was a meeting, so like at the Progressive Student Network, if all the affiliates were going to be, you know, mobilizing for a certain rally, say in D.C. or something, it was one rally that we had at the Pentagon one year, and it was to protest CIA recruitment as well as CIA involvement in El Salvador and so forth. And so we lengthened our trip because we all said, well, we're going to be there, let's have a meeting. So we went to the rally, had a meeting, and then the buses would leave the next day. And they were usually on weekends, and you were usually skipping class on Friday to get the bus and probably back in class on Monday. So yeah, whirlwind is a good way to describe it.
And I guess I'm going to assume there were discussions. I mean, you're on the bus for a long time, mm-hmm. so I'm assuming there was a lot of discussion on the bus about what was going on.
A lot of organizing. You know, every moment we had, we were strategizing and organizing, and maybe it would have to do with, you know, logistics. Here's what we're going to do when we get off the bus. We're going to, you know, get our banner that says Madison, Wisconsin. We're going to, you know, unite behind it. We're going to go meet up with the Minneapolis folks, or, you know, logistics. Or it was an action. You know, if we had an action planned, it would be, you know, talking about who was going to do that and when we were going to do that, whether it was some sort of guerrilla theater or the Macho Nerds for Reagan or Girl Geeks for the Gipper. We would do those kinds of events too.
Since you mentioned that, that's another thing I wanted to talk about. We mentioned that, or you mentioned that, towards the end of our session, the Macho Nerds for Reagan, Girl Geeks for the Gipper, and the idea of satire and guerrilla theater. So I'm wondering if you can recall the genesis, if you will, of that as a way of protest.
Yeah, there was those two groups, and then there was, as I mentioned before, the spoof about the Grenada rescue of the Americans there and how they kissed the ground. And there were other things, too. There was a group on campus that was like a dance group, and they were very involved in the anti-nuclear stuff. And I forget what they were called, but they would do a lot of guerrilla theater just randomly, like during the day. And, you know, maybe we got the idea from them. I mean, the Macho Nerds was really the idea of two people in particular that I can think of. That sort of just were funny, you know, clever people. And I think it started when, I want to say Reagan was here, so it might have been like 83 or something, because he would have ran for re-election in 84. So in the time leading up to that, he was making a trip to Oshkosh. And I think that was the first time we unveiled the Nerds and the Geeks. And then they just sort of reappeared. You know, any event we had, if it seemed appropriate, you know, a few of us would dress up and sort of march around. And it also became a really clever way of isolating hecklers. So at many of our protests, there would be the few college Republicans or, you know, diehard conservatives, very few, that would sort of be on the outskirts of our protests holding up signs or whatever. And so it became a way for us to isolate them. We would go in our gear, in our geek garb, in our nerd garb, and sort of stand around them and pretend to be with them, and then they quickly realized that we were making fun of them, and then they would leave. So it became a neat tactic to sort of get rid of people that we didn't want around.
So I noticed on our website that a couple of people had pulled together that...
Yeah, that's
and
wrong.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, I mean, A, we need to change that, but B... I guess we should say on the website it says that the Nerds were actually pro-Reagan.
Right.
So at the time, did people get the joke?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
because we dressed so crazy. I mean, how could you not get it? You know, I was with Girl Geek for the Gipper, and so, you know, we sort of dressed up like what we thought nerdy girls would dress up like, which, and this was true for the nerds, too. And we did all the stereotypical things. We put the tape in our glasses. We wore glasses, and we put tape, you know, on the nose part there. And we wore our hair in pigtails, and, you know, we wore plaid, and, you know, I forget what the thing... We dressed yuppie, like, you know, had sweaters around us. I mean, it was, you couldn't not get it. But maybe that connotation comes from one of those incidents where we actually did sort of go around with the College Republicans if they were there at an event and pretend to be with them.
Do you think the two people, you said there were two people that sort of instigated this, if you don't think they would mind being having their names mentioned, could you say who they were?
Yeah, one was Chip Young, and the other was John Holst.
Do you know how to spell that
Holst? H-O-L-S-T.
Thank you. So the other thing on my list of things I wanted to follow up with, things that you mentioned, was again that sort of happened at the end of the interview, and that's the Rock Against Reagan, so the fall of 84.
Yeah.
Just wonder if you could maybe elaborate a bit more on that event.
Yeah, that was huge. I wish I could remember the timing. It was nice outside. It was really, really warm and sunny. It was a beautiful day, so it was fall. And whether it was right must have been before the election. I guess, because the election would have been in November, and I think this happened in September or October. It was a beautiful fall day anyway. And I think it was a Friday, and we spent a lot of time organizing this and got bands lined up. And in fact, I think one of the bands we got to play then became sort of, if you might want to call it, like a theme band for the left. Mm-hmm. It's called Swamp Thing. And I don't remember if they were actually there playing or if it was a forerunner of Swamp Thing, and I forget what their name was, so it might have been the forerunner. Anyway, we had them play, and, you know, the friends of ours, essentially, who said, oh yeah, I got a band, and then we tried to get, you know, other acts. I remember we got a rap group from South Side of Madison that we had some connections with, or someone did. I think we got, there was like a women's choir, mostly lesbian women's choir, I forget what it was called, Women's Song, I think, Woman's Song. You know, so we just got all different kinds of music and filled up the day with bands, and we had speakers, and as I said before, there were many issues and events and many groups trying to, you know, get the word out about their activities, and so we made it be sort of a spotlight on, you know, world events, as well as this cultural thing. So we had bands. I don't remember if we had food and stuff. I don't think there was. This was on Library Mall. And I don't recall that at this time there were all the carts that are there today. There were some. Because I remember one of the carts was run by Carl Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And we all knew him. And we'd all go. He didn't know us, but we would go and say, that's Carl Armstrong. So I don't remember if we had refreshments and stuff there, but just the whole day was full of this. And people would, you know, come in and out. And at some points we had huge swells of crowds. We got a lot of news coverage for it. It was a real...
And so that was a Progressive Student Network event.
Yes.
Okay. So one of the questions I didn't have on the list that I just thought of this morning kind of, I think, flows from that, and that's just your general thoughts in the aftermath of that election. I mean, that was a landslide victory in terms of electorally and also popular vote-wise for Reagan. So I'm wondering if you recall how you and your cohorts felt in the aftermath of that.
Right. I don't think any of us had any illusions that there was going to be a change in power. And a lot of us were also involved in, you know, Marxist-Leninist, you know, groups at that time. And, you know, there was this sort of sense that things have to get worse before they get better. And we all would vote Democrat, but we, when Reagan was reelected, you know, we saw it as further opportunity to do the work we had been doing and to, you know, be the watchdog and to sort of sound the alarm, you know, at things that he was either continuing from his previous term or starting anew. There were some people that were demoralized, and these would have been more of the social Democrat types, you know, people who really thought that things would change if you had a Democrat elected. And I think there was a core of us who were just really very left that realized there ain't that much difference between the two parties. And we voted Democrat because we think, or we thought, you know, that things are a little better for people, especially poor people and disadvantaged people, when there's a Democrat in office. And who doesn't want that? But on the other hand, you know, in terms of war and nuclear policies and things like that, there's really little difference. Budget cuts, that kind of thing. So, yeah, there were people that were demoralized, but we maybe succeeded because we weren't, and we kept up, you know, the high level of activism and, you know, didn't let it deter us. In fact, if anything, it spurred us on. And we grew. I mean, that year, 84, was a real growth year for the PSN. You know, the Rock Against Reagan was very popular. I think other things we did during that time were CIA protests of CIA recruiters on campus. That got us a lot of news coverage. I remember being invited on Wisconsin Public Radio to debate Gordon Baldwin, who was a law professor, because I was one of the leaders of the CIA off-campus movement, and we debated, you know, the merits of allowing them on campus. So it was a real growth time for us, and, you know, possibly wouldn't have been had Reagan not been reelected.
So I think I asked this last time, but I want to maybe ask it more specifically, and that's, did you ever get involved in actual working for candidates, either maybe not so much campus candidates, but, you know, local politics, state politics, national politics?
We worked for, a lot of us worked with the Rainbow Coalition when Jesse Jackson ran for president. I think that was 84. And so we were very involved in that. But legislative work was not a big thing for us. We encouraged people to do it because we felt, a lot of us felt like there needs to be inroads made in that area too. But a lot of us, myself included, never really made time for it because, you know, we didn't want to get involved in that or saw it as a dead end or whatever. But we did encourage people, and it was a way for us to include people in our movement who were maybe not as hardcore as we were. It was a way for us to say, well, you know, come to the protests, and you don't have to do all the things we do and risk getting arrested, but how about you, you know, contact, you know, Governor Earl or, you know, who were our congresspeople at that time, Bob Kastenmeier, or, you know, Tammy Baldwin, who was on county board before she was elected to state assembly and then Congress. So, you know, we did value that work, and we did encourage people to do it, either by, you know, really working with the Democratic people in power who could voice or articulate our, you know, our hopes, you know, our programs or issues, or, you know, to Republican, you know, people trying to get them unelected. So we encouraged that. But like I said, it was more of a way for us to involve people in our movement that weren't necessarily going to do the sit-downs and stuff like that. So I think it was a good strategy because it made us seem, I think PSN was at one time the political group on campus that everybody sort of liked. It was like the person in high school that everybody could be friends with, whereas everybody else, you know, had something that, you know, kind of pissed people off. They were too opinionated, they were too this, they were too that. But we were, you know, sort of all-encompassing and could make room for different kinds of activities. We had people with us that were primarily involved in student government, and we saw that as a valuable thing, articulating student, you know, needs and issues to the regents and so forth. We always tried to keep the debate on the left and move them to the left and in some cases, you know, really succeeded. Some people that joined because they were only involved in legislative stuff, I can remember in particular, grew very disheartened with that. And that was kind of our point, you know, was if they get to that point where they're disheartened with it, then they've really learned something. And we felt that that was sort of a victory for the left. But we also valued people who just wanted to do that.
You talked last time about professors, particularly in
Afro-American
studies. I couldn't remember exactly what it was called at that time.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if there were other professors or classes that influenced you. And I say that particularly because you talked a lot about Latin America, events in Latin America.
There were. So in Afro-American studies, there were Professor Ralston, Herbert Hill, Tom Schick, and these were all people that had ties at some point or another to the civil rights movement, and were political minded. And Ralston, in particular, had gone to South Africa during apartheid and gathered interviews and so forth, traveling in the trunk of a car. So they were very politicizing. But there were also other professors. So there was a husband and wife professorial team. Steve Stern was his name, and I forget what her name was. Florencia Mallon, I think. They were married, but they were both professors of, I don't know, Ibero-American Studies or something. And they were very leftist. And they influenced a lot of the folks who eventually sort of specialized in El Salvador or Nicaragua. Liberation theology was a movement in Central America at that time, and they were experts in that. Then there was also, and I'm sure you've heard of him, Harvey Goldstein. So he politicized hundreds of people. And if you got to sit in the front and his spit would come on you as he was talking, you sort of wore that you know, as a badge of honor that you were somehow touched in an even more incredible way by him than just listening to his talks. But for a lot of us, he was the first to deconstruct, you know, sort of what we'd always heard in the past were all these U.S. benevolent actions after World War II and, you know, how we, you know, helped all the people of Central America by overthrowing dictators. Well, he was the first one for a lot of us to deconstruct that and to really tell it like it was, which is how I felt when I was in the Afro-American Studies Department. You know, you learn in school slavery was bad, and fortunately we had a good president who got rid of it, and everything was dandy. You know, well, then we learned, what I learned in college, that the real truth about, you know, black oppression, and there was just so many parallels to, you know, other oppression. And I carry that with me, you know, into what I did, whether it was women's, you know, work or solidarity with the people of El Salvador or whatever else, those same sort of concepts, you know, were relevant. So, and there were other professors, too, in sort of little pockets. There was a guy, Ray Olderman, I think his name was, and he was fired, but he was in comparative literature, very progressive. And he actually then directed some plays at Broome Street Theater, which I was in, one of his plays. He was fired shortly after the TAA strike. I think after the TAA strike, there was a number of faculty that left or were fired or were forced out because of their solidarity with the teaching assistants. So when I got to college after the TAA strike, there was several professors, some of whom I can't even remember the names of, who I remember students older than me saying, oh yeah, this guy left, you know, you should have met him, he was great, he really helped us out during the TA strike. I think there was some cleaning house that the university administration did after that.
But you were able to, did you take a class from this person in Comp Lit, or did you just know about him because of the Broome Street?
I just knew about him because other people had taken classes with him, but then I did a play, I was in a play at Broome Street, and he directed it, so that's how I knew him.
Okay.
But there were still, so even though there were some faculty that had left or were leaving during this time, there was still some of these progressives, like I mentioned, and in, you know, little pockets here and there in other parts of campus. In the ILS program, actually, I would say, I don't remember any of their names, but those professors were very, very progressive.
And just to clarify, I think it's Harvey Goldberg.
It was.
I just want to make
As soon as I said it, I realized it didn't sound right, but I didn't know how.
Right.
Yep, it's Harvey Goldberg, that's right.
Was Professor Mossy still around at that point?
He was.
Did you take classes from him?
No, but I sat in on some lectures because friends of mine said he was just fantastic. So I didn't really appreciate him, I don't think, because I didn't appreciate the subject matter. He was more of like a... I think the things I heard him talk about were like Greek history or Greek wars or something. Mm-hmm. And maybe I just didn't sit in the right lectures, but he was very progressive and a lot of people were influenced by him.
Okay. So there's at least...
And the TAs of these professors too, they were big... You know, like I said, there was the TA strike, but a lot of these professors did, maybe you saw them in lecture, but then in discussion sections it would be the TAs. And those TAs, some of them had been in the TA strike, and they were politicizing influences on us as well.
So the one thing for sure... And again, it's in, on the sort of the scale of stories, it's, I think, a little bit more on the cute side. But at the end, after the recording was off, you talked about being on national TV.
Yeah.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind to retelling that story.
So we took over the state capitol, and I think it was 86. I think I said it was 85 last time, but I'm thinking it was 86. Because I think in 85, we were building up to it. We were doing things like... going to the Board of Regents meeting. We had some sit-ins at the Board of Regents meeting where we always got news media attention. And I think we were trying to get them to divest university funds from South Africa investment entities. And we did some other things, too. There was some... We protested some people on campus or some events where there were speakers that were sympathetic to... I don't know if they were sympathetic to apartheid or just from South Africa. I don't remember now. But anyway, so we built up, you know, along several months of building this up, and then we took over the state capitol. And it was huge. I mean, we had people from labor unions, students, faculty, high school students, a lot of high school students, actually, participating in this. And I really don't remember how we started it, whether we said, you know, let's just go to the capitol and go to the governor's office. I don't know if we actually said, let's make it a sit-in or a stay-in, but that's what happened. So we got up there, and we went to the governor's office. We sort of took it over, and everybody that was there from the Capitol side of things sort of just vacated, and they tried to get us out. We wouldn't leave. We eventually ended up bringing in sleeping bags and sleeping there for, I think, about 2 weeks. And we maintained a presence there, so some of us would leave, and others would come. We had people bringing in food. So it was a big deal. We got a lot of news attention for this, obviously. And our point was made. You know, everybody knew what we wanted, but we were there to protest. And there was other people around the world protesting at the same time. So we were not in a vacuum. It wasn't like, you know, these weird students from Madison. Everybody knew we were part of a movement. But Madison was clearly always seen as a leader, even among other campuses. So we would go to rallies, for example, and everybody would sort of say, oh, Madison's here, you know, great, you know, the leaders. And that was definitely a holdover from the 60s and 70s. But I think we maintained that as much as we could, and this takeover of the state capitol was really unprecedented. No one else around the country was doing it. I remember it was either during this time or shortly after I went out to Columbia. Maybe it was when I went out to be on the television program. Anyway, I think it was. So anyway, the sit-in or the Capitol thing was really sort of big news. And it might have been just freshly over when someone in student government got a call from CBS Morning News. And they said, we're calling the student government to see if you know anything about this protest that was up at the Capitol. And the person on the phone said, well, yeah, because some of them had been involved in it. And they said, well, is there someone we could talk to, like a leader of it? And the person said, well, you know, gave them my name. So they contacted me and asked me if they could fly me out to New York and be on a segment where they would also have students from other campuses, and the whole thing would be talking about a resurgence of student activism in the 80s. So I went out. And as part of my trip out there, I went to Columbia University, where the students there were having their own sort of apartheid anti-apartheid protest. And I remember it was at night, and I think they were in a university building, so they were attempting or succeeding at some sort of stay at the university building. And I remember this huge applause for me, you know, walking in here just from Madison, Wisconsin. And I don't remember what I said. It couldn't have been that eloquent, but you know, it just to know that Madison, you know, they were following in the footsteps of Madison, and that others were, you know, doing this was a big deal, because like we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have cell phones, so the only way we could communicate these things was going around to each other's meetings, and that did mean traveling, or you know, sending communiques. We sent a lot of communiques in those days. You know, let's send a communique to the students of Iowa who are, you know, taking over, you know, the state government, or you know, whatever. So we would send a lot of communiques, but so I took advantage of that trip to New York to go to Columbia and talk to the students, and then was put up in a hotel, very swanky hotel, and I remember marveling at the fact that a cheeseburger from room service cost $12, and there were other students on there. There was one from Columbia University, one from Yale. There was some activities there. I don't remember if they were anti-apartheid or not. And then there was another student. There were four of us from University of Colorado, and I don't know what they were protesting, but the four of us were on CBS Morning News, and as we were parading through the makeup room, we saw Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert sitting in their makeup chairs getting ready for their segment, and chatted with them a bit. And then we got onto the set, and the person who interviewed us, who was working for CBS News at that time, was Maria Shriver. And my dad still has the videotape from this segment. You know, it was only probably, how long do they give this kind of a thing? 5 minutes? And there were four of us on there, so each one of us got to say a few things.
Well, thank you. I wanted to make sure we got that on the record, if you will. So, just a couple of questions to wrap up. The first is you've said a couple of times it took 7 years to get your undergraduate degree. First off, just for the record, what is your undergraduate degree in?
It was in Afro-American history. And, you know, this is going to sound really strange, but when I left, I didn't actually know I graduated. I just left. I thought I graduated, but I didn't really know. And, you know, I worked almost full-time through the whole time, either at the Memorial Union, or then later I got a job at the Monastery restaurant waitressing. And, you know, I was paying for college myself, getting financial aid when I could. So when I left, I didn't really know if I had graduated. So I moved to Chicago, lived there for about a year, then moved to New York for a couple of years, and moved back to Wisconsin then, 1990 or so. And I remember a friend of mine was working up at the university, and it was Joe Mingle, actually. And something came up about how, I don't know if I graduated or not. And he said, well, let me find out. So I'm sure you can't do this now, but at that time he actually found out. He said, yeah, you graduated, but you have a fine of like $80 or something. You have to pay the fine. And then they'll release your graduation. So I was like, oh, okay, great. So I paid the fine, and I guess I graduated. But at that time, for a lot of us, you know, going through graduation ceremony, doing all that stuff was just not important. And, you know, I had, you know, mostly done student activism and was going to go off and do more activism. You know, I worked for a union as a labor organizer for a while. So this was where a lot of us were heading, and we didn't think we needed a college degree for that. So later in life, I, you know, did value that. And I actually went back to school, got another bachelor's degree, and then a master's degree and a PhD. But for the first one, you know, it wasn't just the most important thing for me.
I wonder if you could give you gave the really tight overview there about coming back to school and now what you do. But maybe I'll ask it this way. I mean, your first degree's in Afro-American history. You're now here in the Department of Urology. How did that happen?
So I was a labor organizer for several years after college, and it was for the nurses union here in Madison, and it was a great job, and I really felt like my skills were being utilized, but there was a political issue that kind of tore the union apart. It was over the privatization of UW Hospital, and there was about half of the nurses who were for it, and about half the nurses were against it, and I was sort of in league with those who were against it, and turns out that was on the wrong side of the executive director and the president, and so I kind of got fired. I think I technically left, but I would have been fired. And then I got sick. I don't know, it was just this weird thing. I got viral encephalitis. Strange, weird thing. Don't know, you know, could have been transmitted by a mosquito. Some of those viruses are transmitted that way. They don't know. Anyway, was in the hospital for about a week and had some rehab after that, at which point I decided to go back to school. And I was married at that time and decided to do healthcare and become a dietitian. So a lot of my credits from the undergraduate degree I got were usable, but since it was a science degree, I had to really kind of take a whole lot of new courses. So I got a second bachelor's degree and did an internship to become a registered dietitian. Then also went to grad school, got a master's degree and a PhD. And, you know, through that really developed an interest in science. And, you know, in some weird way, being political and being a Marxist-Leninist for those years in college, you know, really paved the way for me to think scientifically and to think. So I say that was part of my training. And yeah, I'm a scientist and also a registered dietitian, but all of the skills I learned in activism in terms of communicating with people, motivating people, I use those in my counseling skills. Organizing people, I use that in my scientific skills. And on the side, you know, I'm involved in community things and have gone to El Salvador several times on a Habitat for Humanity type project. So, you know, organizing for that, still using all the skills I learned as a student activist. And politically, I'm still where I was there. I just don't overtly, you know, express it or do it, you know, daily like I did then.
So I was going to ask sort of the question about how sort of what you think the legacy is of your activism. It sounds like you sort of answered that for you personally. I mean, but what do you think the legacy in general of the activism that came out of the 80s?
I think it gave people tremendous skills. I think, you know, we did a lot of things that no other students were doing. We, you know, communicated with legislators when we needed to. We, you know, dealt with the regents. We dealt with student government. We, you know, debated professors of law on the radio. We confronted, you know, the powers that be in many forms. Some people got arrested. We did legal work, you know. So I think those are all good skills. And I think any type of organizing where you have to learn how to talk with people and vary the delivery of your message depending on the person's ability to understand it or where they're at politically or emotionally, anytime you have to work at doing that, you are learning really, really valuable skills. And a lot of the people that I know who were involved at that time, friends of mine, are now in positions where they are using those skills. Several of them are professors. Some of them are lawyers. Others are activists. They're employed by activist organizations like unions, or they're teachers. And in all these capacities, in all these situations, I see them using the same skills that they learned, or some skills that they learned at that time anyway. And so I think that's one legacy. And I think the other legacy is that, you know, there's no such thing as destiny. You create your future. And I think that sense of we make things happen, sort of, if it didn't infuse you and get into you at that time, it was never going to get there. So I have to believe that a lot of people who would not otherwise never have experienced that, and now hopefully are living that way, you know, where they're actively trying to change their community. You know, I'm involved in the little community organization in my town, for example, where we try to make the lake a better place, try to make the parks better, just things like that. That I think if you didn't have any experience at all, whether it's a church organization or political organization or whatever, maybe you wouldn't do those things.
Chris, is there anything else you want to say about either about your time in the 80s or anything that you've talked about that you want to add to or elaborate on?
Well, one question that always comes up is, you know, where is student activism today? And people were asking that in the 80s, and I remember we would be throwing up our hands saying, we're here. But people were always comparing it to the 60s or 70s. And there's never going to be another time like that because technology has changed. So you don't have people assembling in large groups anymore for the most part because a lot of stuff is done online or, you know, by email. So I think, you know, when people say, where's the activism, I think it's still there. And I think it's perhaps as strong as ever. It's just that it has taken a different form. And I see it on campus today. I see students, you know, black students in particular, organizing in a way that I haven't seen them do in before, you know, before this. There's always, I think campuses are always going to be sort of a hotbed of radicalism and empowerment in many forms. And I think when people compare it to years past, they miss the point.
Well, I think that's a nice place to end. So, Chris, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So this concludes Your Oral History with Chris Peniston.